Welcome to Geeks On, a show created by geeks for geeks, covering topics that geeks like to talk about. This week, it's Geeks On Love from Beyond. For more information and news we talk about in the show, go to our website at www.geekson.com. Hey, everybody!
Welcome back,
my geeklings,
to an episode of Geeks On.
Now in glorious mono!
Nice. Why are you going to bring that up?
Sounds bad.
Don't we have to be, like, you know, quarantined for, like, 2 weeks or something?
No. Not mononucleosis, Don. Monooral.
The other kissing.
Speak for yourself.
The other mono.
Wait, yeah, you can get the other from oral,
that
too.
That sounds really wrong.
Well, you know, that's the way I roll. Dun-dun-dun.
Hi, my name is Aaron. I'm a graphic designer and filmmaker here in Hollywood, and I'm a geek.
Hi, I'm Pete Robinson. I'm a screenwriter here in Los Angeles, and I am a geek.
My name is Matt King. I am an actor here in Los Angeles, and I am a geek.
My name is Donald Marshall. I'm a video game professional here in sunny Hollywood, and I, too, am a geek.
And there's less of Don today.
Now with 50% less Don.
Yeah. Exactly. Is it? Are you up to 50% less Don?
No, not even close.
No.
So I want to apologize. It's been a little while since our last podcast. We have had crazy stuff happening here.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Matt has a child on the way.
I have a child on the way in a little bit. I booked a CBS pilot. So for all of y'all who have been listening to Geeks On for the last 4 years and the trials and travails of Matt's acting career, I just booked a CBS pilot, and we'll see where it goes.
Yay!
We'll see.
Yep. Series regular.
I don't know how many. I can't get a number on how many pilots CBS has ordered, so I can't figure out. Like, I don't know if they've ordered a heavy amount or not. So
yep.
Who knows.
Awesome.
Yeah, crazy. But how was your guys' geek weeks?
Weeks, good.
Many geek weeks.
My Xbox has died.
Again?
It's on the way back. By the way,
we're naming your next one Lazarus.
You know, Microsoft turned it around in less than a week.
Yeah,
so it should
yeah
be,
they're very fast.
So it should be Jesus, actually.
That's fast.
Yeah.
Are you guys playing anything?
Well, apparently they've had lots of practice at this. So.
Yeah, they have.
I've still been Fallouting like crazy.
So you're still in Fallout.
Yeah, I've been.
Did anybody try the Halo Wars demo?
No.
No.
Nobody has.
Mm-mm.
All right. Well, I'm not.
I've seen it.
You have my Xbox.
It's a real-time. Oh, that's right. I do. I need to give that back to you.
I've still been playing Left 4 Dead every once in a while.
You have my Xbox and it's sitting here. It's not even hooked up?
No. I've been working.
What, you borrowed it? You borrowed it for, like, you know, to put your drinks on or something? I mean,
I bought it for the party.
Oh,
it's like Rock Band.
Is that what it was for? Okay,
yeah.
I've been playing Left 4 Dead, but I picked up Street Fighter, the new Street Fighter game, and I went right back to Left 4 Dead.
How is it?
You'll
been
like
getting
it.
Good reviews.
Well, there's a certain type of player who will really enjoy it. Matt is the type of player who will really like it because
I
it's
like
about,
learning every single move that a character plays.
Yeah, Matt loves that. Like, and so when you have that 10-string hit combo, Matt loves that.
Yes.
For me, that's the bane of my existence. Like, I just want to play intuitively. I don't want to remember anything more than 3 steps. You know, and then the Street Fighter super moves, the way they've included them.
Mm-hmm.
Everything else is redundant. It doesn't matter what you do in the game. I can throw you till the cows come home. I can kick you in the head. As soon as you get off that super move, you're going to do all the damage I've done plus more.
But is the super move hard to get off? I mean,
not especially, but like with some characters, they are. Here's my flaw, right? With some characters, it's a double fireball motion. For those of you who don't play video games, that means down, swoop to the front, down, swoop to the front, press the like a punch button or something, right? So you can do that really quick and just get it off, right? But if you play characters that I like, right, E Honda, Chun-Li, those ones you have to charge back 2 seconds, forward, back, forward, and then hit the proper buttons.
Which is rather difficult to do.
Which, one, is hard to do. It's a hard motion because you have to do it exactly on a plane. And two, that means I can't just go forward, punch. I have to charge back 2 seconds and then do it. So it takes me a 2 second delay to get off that attack. Whereas somebody playing the cheapo characters like Ken or Ryu can just immediately go into the mega hit combo without thinking about
hush
it.
Hush with you.
Well, so you're saying it's not balanced.
Fireball uppercut, fireball
you're
uppercut.
You're saying the characters uppercut. Are not balanced.
I'm saying that there's
for
a
you,
the
yes,
for
he's,
you.
The style of playing I do. If I can't do that super move, I'm dead in the water. I don't stand a chance against someone who does. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's imbalancing.
It does seem like a super move like that should have some downside to it. Like the charging is a good idea for a super move. Mm-hmm. That it should it should be hard to get off.
There's also a certain skill about being able to charge in midair while you're doing other moves and then coming out of those things. But
there are ways around
that. Takes a level of 12-year-oldism that is kind of excessive.
Well, but which apparently you have.
No, like on
I still have the skills from back in the day. My cousin Adam is the one who's ridiculous.
Oh, really?
He's the one who used to be able to take one of the characters and make him like handcuff people and stuff like that, which was like, or he could shut off the video game. If he got pissed off at somebody, he knew like the set of button combos to shut off the video game.
Hmm.
Yeah. So.
Wow.
Yeah.
Have you played the new Left 4 Dead maps? Are they out yet?
I looked the other day. They weren't out yet.
Oh, okay.
But I'm eagerly
and that's
waiting.
Three new play modes or something. Or one new play mode, three new maps.
Three new versus modes, one new campaign mode, as far as I understand.
Oh, there is a new campaign.
And there's new Fallout.
Oh, there's a campaign mode, right. But there's not a new campaign yet. No new
campaign. I'm not sure.
Okay.
I'm not sure.
This is free, though, so that's a good thing.
But, I mean, the thing that I really enjoy about it is, yes, I'm playing the same freaking map I played a dozen times before, but you're playing with different people, mm-hmm. so the way that it makes for a different game. Mm-hmm. Like, when you have that group of people with one dumbass that runs off by himself all the time, mm-hmm. do you let him die and risk the rest of your lives, or does somebody have to go over and try and help him and protect his dumbass when he's running off into the sewer by himself?
And maybe have them die, too.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I like it. It feels very cinematic still.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, I'm the only one here playing Versus. I don't know where the rest of the hell of you are.
Played the game at all.
I'm in limbo.
No, yeah, because Aaron's using my Xbox
as a coaster.
I offered to give it back the other day.
You know, I thought you were using it, man. I was like, I.
All right, I'm going to get mine back in the next couple of days, and we'll jump back on.
But I'm definitely in the market for the next co-op game. The Left 4 Dead thing has really hit home to me that I even do like FPSs when they are co-op.
Why don't we rent the latest Call of Duty is 4-person co-op.
Yeah, I'm on board for
and
that.
And I hear it's fun.
Yeah, that's, I'm down for that.
I mean, I
I'm
got
really
it for
down
my,
that.
Lisa got it for me for my birthday, so I have it. I think you can probably rent it and, you know, at least Gamefly it if you guys don't want to buy it. And we'll do 4-person co-op.
I'm there.
Okay.
Ready.
By the way, all of those geeks who helped me out, because I put a big shout out on the Geeks On forum because my hard drive crashed and I needed help in recovery. Yes, it was the shell. And Peter hooked me up with a guy named Mark Cooper here in Los Angeles. And this guy was amazing. He fixed my hard drive, which everybody at Best Buy and like that quoted me like $1,500 on. And he fixed it for free. And just sent me out, cracked the thing open, fixed it for nothing. So if you want somebody who's really, really awesome at knowing how to fix hard drive problems, now I have a guy.
But it also brings up, you know, that's one thing that people, there are all sorts of small places out there that actually know what they're doing. These like Fry's, Best Buy's, these are kids that have been trained.
To a certain extent,
and they're just going to give you a new hard drive or say you can't do it. There are people out there who will look at it, and they will get your data off those things.
Yeah. And there's a good chance that they're geeks, too.
Yeah, man.
You'd be supporting your geek community.
Yeah, I mean, from $1,500 to have somebody look at it, crack it open, and go, here's the part. Go to Fry's, buy the part for $20, and you're done.
Yeah.
And don't buy that brand anymore either, which that was fantastic.
Yeah, so. He's really funny how he's actually pretty big in the hard drive recovery sector. So he'll know a lot of the hard drives that fail that nobody else knows about this because he sees all the same hard drives all the time.
Who's saying his name?
Mark Cooper. He was saying
a list.
Yeah, he was saying like don't buy terabyte drives, which was fascinating to me because he said that certain terabyte drives are especially like unsolid and they crap
buy
out
the, on hard drives. You never want to buy the absolute limit that's out.
Hmm.
Like they're always pushing, you know, the limits of that, and you're always, you know, just
because they've just figured out how to do it and maybe not that well.
Yeah, cheap.
Yeah.
You know, cheap enough for us to buy it. It's so they're
the
like barely hanging on.
Problem with being an early adopter. I'll say it again.
Yeah, well, that's true.
Was that on a PC or a Mac?
It was on PC.
Oh.
Bye, Mac. All right, anything else?
Because nothing bad ever happens to a Mac.
Except the whole thing blows up.
And then you have to get a whole new computer.
All right, anything else before news?
No. Well, not for me.
No, it's just
all right,
news.
Let's do some news. All right, let me just start real quickly because I have two movie news slash announcements.
He's eager.
A lot of you people actually know this because there's some rumblings on the internet, but for those of you who don't, apparently Ghostbusters 3 might start filming this coming fall.
No way.
Now, the funny thing is this has been like, you know, the rumor has been like that this was never going to happen. In fact, the video game that
is supposed to be Ghostbusters 3.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Right. Well, now the rumors are that
it's gonna roll.
Going to roll.
Because they saw the probably early numbers on what people wanted to buy for the video game. And they were like, yeah, all right.
Maybe.
Just don't be Viggo the Carpathian. Don't suck.
Dan Aykroyd has said... Dan Aykroyd has actually said that the script is being written right now.
Wow.
Cool.
Well, I mean, the first one is just so freaking good. The second one couldn't even hold up. But the thing is,
The second one had nice little points.
But it's like Star Wars.
It had
it's
ectogelly.
Like enough nice moments to make the things that sucked look that much worse.
Yes. I'll go ahead on board with that.
You know?
It had ecto flubber.
It had that little guy who was playing the Eastern European guy I thought was hilarious.
Yeah, Peter McNichol.
Peter McNichol rocked in that movie.
Brilliant.
I thought he was hilarious.
He was also in one of my other favorite geek movies, Dragon Slayer.
Yeah. Oh,
love it.
And he didn't quite rock that one as much.
I love Dragon Slayer.
Oh, no, it's a great movie.
I would hear nothing bad against
him. He was very bland in that.
Yeah. He's the guy who won an Academy Award.
Yeah, he's on Numbers now.
Right.
Well, I'm excited. I hope that they do a good job with it. Do you know what the plot is?
No.
Did you ever see the cartoon, the real Ghostbusters?
No.
Which they had the licensing fight with the other Ghostbusters cartoon?
No, I haven't.
That was a great cartoon. And it had plots week to week that were fabulous. I mean, they could steal one of the plots from there. There was one on the boogeyman and how they were chasing the boogeyman. The boogeyman was going from closet to closet to closet to closet to closet from kids' rooms everywhere. That would be a great movie. I mean, just steal that one and you're done.
Yep. Call up Dan.
All right.
The other one is another Alien film. Not Alien versus Predator, but another Alien film with Sigourney Weaver.
Sigourney Weaver? Really?
She's ready to do it. She wants it to happen. Apparently, there's a... In this article, there says there's a Joss Whedon script that was written about... for Alien 5 that took place on Earth, and she was like, eh, no. She says she doesn't like the idea of it coming to Earth. She says it just kind of...
Is it because she gave the alien a human womb?
More importantly, is it still going to have the womb when it gets to Earth?
Oh.
Are they going to keep...
Didn't
is that going to keep
up?
That as canon?
How many times is she going to die?
Who, Sigourney Weaver?
Didn't she die at the end
But that was...
No, it's going to be...
Spoiler alert! That one was a clone.
It's going to be her and Boba Fett in a gigantic clone army.
Whatever. Oh, in Thunderdome.
In Thunderdome.
This just proves, again, that Fox has zero respect for this franchise.
Fox just wants another installment in the franchise. That's all they care about.
Exactly.
Come on, man.
Actually, I think Aliens
is
also
what
we're saying about Terminator.
And I'll go see it. I mean,
I think the aliens coming to Earth and getting released would actually be a good story.
I think, well, maybe not actually on Earth. I think maybe like... Or hovering above Earth at a space station. Like, it is
funny.
About ready to get there.
I rented Aliens versus Predator 2.
Yeah.
Right? I don't remember seeing this movie because it was so bad, apparently. My roommate tells me.
Number
I saw
two?
It. Two.
I saw one, and I cracked up all the way through it.
Ugh.
Well, one, yeah. But one at least was bizarre. Like, I think two was just so humdrum, uninspired, and dull that I actually blocked it out of my memory. He's convinced I sat in my living room and swore at the TV set for 2 hours once upon a time.
That movie was...
But that was Aliens on Earth. They did it.
Yeah, well, so was the first one.
Yeah, that was Aliens in the Arctic in like a 1 square mile area.
Well,
it was sort of lame.
Yeah. That they might have gotten out.
Yeah, like I want aliens in New York City,
yeah.
You know, or Boston or Los Angeles or something.
No,
aliens in Boston.
This
too.
Is what Sigourney.
Hey, what was that?
This is what Sigourney Weaver said. Maybe I kind of agree with it in that point. Is that she believes that the setting is a very important. She wants it to be an interesting, strange setting, and aliens in New York wouldn't necessarily.
Alien Australia.
No, I don't know about New York, but I think aliens on the planet would be interesting.
Aliens in China.
Like, well, literally taking over the whole fucking planet.
It doesn't have to be
now.
I mean, it would be the future, right?
You know?
Aliens in Japan.
It's going to be a strange, exotic future.
It should be a futuristic world that it's happening in. But it shouldn't look like... If it looks like this, okay? Yeah. If it looks like your neighborhood, no, I don't really think that would be that good.
What's wrong with my neighborhood?
It's not
futuristic.
Yeah,
it's got to be Blade Runner meets...
If it looks like that, like your Blade Runner poster, that would be freaking awesome.
Yeah, I'm on board with that.
Aaron's gigantic.
I don't really care where it said it's, you know, but I just think it's done. And Sigourney Weaver does not have to be in the movie.
Right.
To be a great alien movie.
No,
true.
In fact, at this point, she probably shouldn't be.
Well, no, I would actually say, like, having interrogations with her on tape as, like, a way that somebody's studying up on the aliens.
Yeah.
Like, you know, this is from her from 200 years ago.
Back, yeah, or
that'd
something.
Be awesome.
A virtual construct of her.
Yeah.
You know.
Why don't we take it to the alien planet this time?
Well, actually, if you were going to do it, fine. What would be interesting would be to...
And then the Borg come in.
They have her personality, a digital copy of who she is, and they put her into a robotic person like the person that she's always hated.
Mm.
That would be really interesting. She basically realizes that she's a robot.
Oh, and the robots have kind of betrayed her in the past.
Yeah, and she realizes and she's become the thing that like fucked
and
her
then
up
it's the robots versus aliens.
Right,
how come you guys don't like any of my plots?
Oh, the other thing I wanted to bring up is two other rumors. Battlestar Galactica movie may be coming out.
Yes, I heard that.
But based off of the original series, because that guy still owns the rights to that.
Did you read the Dirk Benedict, like...
Oh, my God.
Wrath
that was bizarre.
Wrath of Dirk, most misogynistic letter...
No.
Ever, where he refers to Starbuck as Stardo because she's you know she's never going to be a Starbuck, she'll always be a Stardo. I'll see if I can find it.
Yeah,
it was fascinating.
I found it in the Geeks on forums, it's
we should put like official link because that sounds pretty good.
Yeah.
The other thing is, you guys know that there is a V reboot.
Yes,
being made.
That's awesome. That's a
that
good
one
idea.
Deserves a reboot.
And you know what? I think it deserves a reboot, but it needs to be, I think, hardcore, gritty.
Okay, here's the issue that I have, because I just saw it in the breakdowns, and actually I was like, submit me on it. Oh, no, I booked a pilot. And then I was like, hey,
This shoots up in Vancouver.
Yeah, it shoots up in Vancouver. But the thing is, the thing that was cool about V was that we always knew that something was wrong when we were watching the miniseries originally, or the TV right. show originally, but we didn't know what. Yeah. And so the cool thing about V was the ultimate reveal of the lizard aliens, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We knew
their
were bad,
plan.
But we didn't learn their evil plan until three quarters of the way through however long it went.
Mm-hmm.
This, we're coming in with that knowledge. So I feel like it loses a little bit on
I
the
think
way
they
in.
Need to change up the reveal.
Okay.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. Because also, like, the concept of them coming and stealing our water, while very pertinent to the current issues we're having with water supply in the United States,
mm-hmm.
and if you don't know what I'm talking about, go read a book.
I don't know. If you can fly that distance between planets, you can probably create water.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They need to think of a smarter concept.
They're stealing our atmosphere.
No. It's people! It's a cookbook!
No. All right. I'm done.
All right. So, City of Heroes has a new system that they're using.
Please!
Which will allow their players to create their own content.
Please!
Which is kind of a cool idea.
Okay.
Content meaning stories and stuff?
Yeah. Basically, they have
So you could actually, like, GM a game?
Well, not that you would GM it, per se, because you create it pre-rendered so that people will run through it, but you're not actually running it out live. Does that make sense?
That's cool. You create adventures that
it's a module. You create a module that the computer runs.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So, you know, so basically they have this thing called the Architect Entertainment, a company that has developed a virtual training program for superpowered beings, which is – so what you're really creating is virtual, you know, training programs. They're not real –
Oh, it's
so they don't actually offer you experience or anything with it.
Well,
the world?
No, they do offer you real experience, but it's but the point is that like the point is that
you can't mess up the world.
Yeah.
So all the adventures are considered virtual, so they don't. Someone doesn't create something that screws up the
continuity.
Main, yeah, the continuity of the main world.
So it's
yeah.
all like the danger room.
Yeah.
Yes. Eh. It, well, which is a little bit lame. It's true.
But
although,
when you have you played City of Heroes?
Yes.
Okay.
I actually kind of liked it.
So you know, basically, what happens is you walk through a door, and then you're in a big danger room scenario.
Yeah.
You know, it's but it's not going to be different.
Well,
they
were all. It was all instances. It was yeah. all in, but the thing about it that I thought could have been interesting with this idea is that, hey, maybe they would extrapolate it out beyond that and gotten a little bit more to the, you know, Spidey universe, which is what I was hoping City of Heroes would have been, you know, like the Spider-Man video game where you could really, like, do things within the city and, but no.
It seems virtually impossible in an MMO.
You do it in World of Warcraft?
Well, actually, World of Warcraft doesn't really change
really.
Yeah, that
much.
What do
you do that changes anything?
See, what would
Warcraft?
Be great in World of Warcraft would be, you know, when you play the original, you know, sort of, what do you call it when you're looking from above down version?
Top down.
The top down.
Top down version. You know, was the sense that that there was actually, you know, like if the Horde came in, you would see the whole world starting to change.
Yeah.
You know, it would get darker and, you know.
Now, Warhammer Online here is more like that. Like,
yeah, if you, because you can control the keeps. And,
yeah, if you take down a city there, yeah. it changes it for everybody.
Well, that's what I was going to say. It would be so much more interesting if in World of Warcraft that happened. If you would see, literally, there would be an area that if the undead take over, everything would wither and the trees would die. You know, but if the elves came back in and did a series of quests, it would come back to life.
Yeah.
You know, that would be really
I'd really like that.
Well, World of Warcraft 2.
Yeah, probably.
So,
yeah.
Fun
but,
dream.
So anyway, City of Heroes, basically, you can create your own content and, you know, people will vote up the best ones.
I think that's an awesome
I think this
idea.
Is – well, it's a great idea because you're letting people be innovators and there's 1,000 trillion more people out there who will create content than you. Some of them are going to be good.
Well, it's also going to be a last gasp for the City of Heroes franchise as Champions starts coming to the fore.
Absolutely.
Champions Online, same company, will be releasing, I think, this year.
See, what I'm just curious about, though, is like as soon as you add user-generated content, you get the YouTube phenomenon where, yeah, there are gems in there. They're absolute gems, but you got to dig through so much schlock.
But it depends on how they, you know, like – again, like YouTube, we all seem to find the funny memes that pop up.
Oh, sure.
Like
right. At least some of them. I mean, even if you only find a percentage of the ones that are out there.
Well, see, Little Big Planet is doing the same thing. You know, it's all about user-created content, and they have to set up a system where it floats, you know, the good stuff floats.
That's exactly what I was going to say. They need to figure out a way that the good stuff floats.
Yeah.
Exactly what you said. Never all mind. Right.
So, a U.S. and a Russian communication satellite have collided in space in the first such reported accident. A satellite owned by a U.S. company, Iridium, hit a defunct Russian satellite at high speed, nearly 780 kilometers over Siberia on Tuesday. Well, this is a while ago. Basically, it said it's the first time this has happened. NASA's now tracking the hundreds of pieces of wreckage from the collision. There's no risk to the International Space Station, but they're wondering whether or not there's any risk to our few last shuttle missions.
Well, first
this
of all,
to me, however, sounds like a cover up. It sounds like one of those things that they invent
they
in like a Sam Fisher game,
yeah.
You know, and the Russians are like, oh, it was a defunct satellite, not the space station.
It was space collision.
Yeah, space collision. Don't know how this happened. Yeah.
There is thousands and thousands of pieces of space junk up there, and I hear it's getting crazy. But the chances of that happening just seems astronomical.
That's
it just seems
why I
impossible.
Think it's like, huh? You know, what was the thing on the ground, and the Russians put this, you know, Star Wars thing up there, and the U.S. was like, well, we have a satellite nearby, and we can use its retro thrusters to like.
There are probably two space combat satellites that we don't know it's up there. We were on the brink of World War III and we didn't know it. One shot the other one. The other person almost had their finger on the button and then something got talked down and then now it's just space collision bullshit. Great!
I think they should develop satellites that have like electromagnets in them that you basically you put up there whenever something metal comes near it. It turns on the electromagnet, so it just starts collecting the space
like
debris.
Like a big Katamari Damacy
ball? Yeah, exactly. Great. A space Katamari ball, so it can we can clear all the shit out of our atmosphere.
And eventually we'll have another moon.
I bet, right. I bet you that'll be one of the first projects when we actually do successfully create the space elevator. That'll be the first thing they do
space
is...
Space vacuum?
No, because you need a counterweight to lift things up. Right, that's one of the premises of how it works. So gather the junk up top, load it on the elevator, and it's perfectly recyclable material as our first load to bring something else up.
That's fascinating. Just fascinating.
Okay,
that's a good idea, right. Don.
So I recently had some sick time and had plenty of time to read things that I really didn't want to spend any sort of brain power on because I was going to be heavily sedated during the time. So. Having recently enjoyed World War Z, I was like, you know, besides this book, I have never actually read a zombie book, right? So considering how many zombie movies I've seen and zombie video games I play...
You're a zombie fan.
I should stroll into this whole new world of zombie books. And perhaps it was a mistake, because... so far, the ones I've read, they're... I don't know what it is. I mean, it's a rich genre that has enjoyed extreme commercial success. You'd assume some good writers would wander into this territory. But so far, I haven't really found anything that's really excited me. So I brought two books of the series that I've read so far in to discuss.
Which are?
The first one is The Rising by Brian Keene. Now, according to Amazon and a couple like zombie fan pages on the web.
This is awesome.
This is awesome. And like, I'm supposed to be incredibly angry at the end of this book when I discover that it's like the first half of a two-part book. You know, it's actually a part of a trilogy.
Mm-hmm.
So the basic premise with this one is it starts...
better or worse than Twilight?
Post-outbreak.
Sorry.
So you don't actually get to see much in the way of things breaking out. That starts with a guy in a bomb shelter. And there's a dozen zombies up top trying to dig through the ground to get to him. The big twist on this one, and I'm not, these are sort of spoilers, but you find out the stuff I'm talking about in the first 100 pages, so okay. I don't consider it to be that big a wreck. The zombies are intelligent in this one, and they are inhabited by demons from Sumeria. So they're sort of like...
Damn those demons from Sumeria.
The spirits that people used to call djinn and ifrit and all of sort of the evil spirits in the world are coming back and inhabiting anything that dies.
Wasn't Gozer the Gozerian a demon from Sumeria?
In essence...
Probably.
They've somehow opened Pandora's box.
Yes, and they've basically tied it at this point to the massive super collider that was supposed to... The Hadron Collider that might create a black hole. Well, it didn't create a black hole, but it did puncture a hole to the demon dimension where God put all of these demons.
They crossed the streams.
Well, yeah.
Duh. So the problem is, like, okay, now this premise doesn't sound that bad, right? It's sort of like, oh, demon zombies running amok, and some of them, and they do run, and they use tools, and they drive cars, and they can run you over in motorcycles and stuff.
But they have to eat human flesh?
They have to eat human flesh, but they don't know why in this book that I finished. They never, because they're intelligent, they never eat so much that the body can't reanimate. Because they have the goal of getting their brothers and sisters back from the other dimension, so they need bodies, right? Mm-hmm. And they need any body. So there's a lot of stuff in here like demon gophers kill people and
demon gophers?
Deer. Yeah, I think there was one demon gopher mauling.
What do you mean? Like some freaked out zombie version of Caddyshack?
Yes.
Wow.
Demon
zombie birds.
Now, you know, do the zombies have some type of social system with like a government? Or how does that work if they're that?
Yes, good? Apparently so. The zombies at this point are gathering in a couple different areas that they mention. But now, here's the thing. The zombies have this kind of slick, smart-ass, Spider-Man-esque sort of banter speak that they spout at you every time they're coming out after to kill you. They're cheeky little zombies, right? Which completely gets rid of any sort of fear that you might have for these things when you read them. It's like they're sassy little zombies that are there to just chat you up while they chew your arm off. And it's like...
The zombie cop is like...
It's
hey,
lame.
Man, take a bite out of crime.
Yeah, literally, exactly that is a line from the book. You know, like that is the perfect line from the book.
There you go.
And the animals can speak too, apparently. So it's like...
Yeah, that's not a good choice.
No, it's bad stuff, you know? And there's... Because you start post-outbreak... Like, for me, one of the great things about zombie books is the descent of humanity, right? Mm-hmm. Like, the survival instinct taking over our higher instincts, or the fight to preserve
them. This would be great if there was some reveal... Like, you didn't know, and then the whole mystery is how we got that way, and that was, like, the big reveal. That
exactly.
Could
and they blow everything in the first 100 pages. After that point, you don't really learn anything new. Mm. But all you do get to see is how
pithy zombies
flaming assholes humans are just a couple months after the outbreak. Like, you don't see people get to that point. They're just there. Okay. They're dicks. So, The Rising... very highly rated on most zombie websites. It's by Brian Keene. Do not recommend this book. It's got a lot of gore.
It's a winner of the Bram Stoker Award, I see.
Yes, in fact it is. And I don't understand. It makes me think maybe the other Bram Stoker Award winners aren't so hot either.
Okay. What's the other book, Eric?
The second one.
This looks like a manual.
Well, I bought this one because I thought it would be interesting to read another book, again, by a Bram Stoker Award winner, Kim Paffenroth. There you go. Dying to Live, Life Sentence. This is actually the second book in a zombie series. I thought it would be interesting to read a zombie book written by a woman with a slightly different perspective on zombies. This one does have a different perspective. I actually enjoyed this one on a much more casual level. I still don't recommend it as being a good book, but it's very different than all the other zombie books I read.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. This one, again, keep in mind this is the second in a series. It starts well after the outbreak. You're actually about 12 years after the outbreak has occurred in a settlement of people that have survived and built a perimeter and are farming and have a decent life together. This one actually plays up the higher aspects of men's humanity winning out. Mm-hmm. It's a town of very nice people who have sort of a hippy-dippy community going on. There's no real leader, but they're all sort of, you know, zen and cooperating with each other and teaching each other French and ballet and stuff while they farm.
This is zombie?
Meanwhile, they're surrounded by armies of zombies who want to eat them, right?
Okay.
The twist on this one is you follow a 12-year-old girl as she is coming of age in the society and the rituals she has to go through to take her place in society, and also a zombie as he starts to gain self-awareness again and starts to... remember certain things. And so this zombie actually remembers how to read, and he has a grasp of language. And so although he can't speak because he's too decayed. So the premise of this one is you're following the journal of the 12-year-old girl and the memoirs of the zombie after he's found a typewriter that he's managed to put together sentences on.
Interesting.
So this one is a little bit more interesting as far as just sort of a human dynamic story. As far as an actual story, though, it falls a little short. Nothing really big happens over the course of the book. It's just sort of an examination of life for both sides. And the big... I'm not going to blow anything for you, but the big sort of blowout climax of the book is actually quickly deflated as mankind's higher instincts win out and people talk their way through their situations.
Sounds like a television show.
With zombies.
Like a television script.
Yeah. So if you're going to pick up a zombie book, this one's better than the others I've read so far.
Dying to Live, Life Sentence.
World War Z was fantastic. I just finished that too.
Yeah.
And it was great.
I kind of figured, well, if this is an example of the genre, awesome.
I think that's
not so much.
I think that's an example of the highest form of the genre. But also, what was it? Is it Dead Rising? There's a great comic book that's really good.
Walking Dead.
Walking Dead, that's
it. Yeah, Walking Dead is a phenomenal comic book, but it follows the formula of the movies,
yes.
Right? And with that, what basically they do is each sort of story arc is another movie, another kind of classic movie of the genre, but it just segs into the next one. So the story never ends.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of like, yeah, great, you escaped from the mall, but now you're back out in the world of zombies with no defense. What happens next?
Right.
You know?
So, I would love to do a zombie short story. I may have to do this. In honor of the topic today, Love Never Dies, I'd love to do a zombie short story about two people who turn into zombies.
And they're still in love.
And they're still in love. Why not? The guy, you know, trying to take care of his wife. So he's you know, he's going off and dragging humans over so his wife can eat them.
Well, that particular part is not in Dying to Live, a Dying to Live life sentence, but there is a zombie love story in the book. So, and I have read other synopses of other others that have, you know, the guy with the girlfriend who's become a zombie in the basement and he's feeding her people. You know, it's sort of a common recurring theme.
Well, in honor of... oh, you have another one?
No, go ahead.
Okay. In honor of our topic today, there is a guy who was talking in this in the Pirate Bay court case, and he's a professor named Roger Wallace. And the court asked him if he wanted to be reimbursed for his appearance, and he said, "Well, you're welcome to send some flowers to my wife." You know, instead of saying, "Give me money," he said, "Yeah, go ahead and send some flowers to my wife if you feel like it," kind of just as an offhand thing. Well, all the people who heard this from Pirate Bay sent his wife like thousands of bouquets of flowers. Like they've just started, they just started showing up. The local flower shop is overwhelmed.
All the pirates, not official.
All the pirates, yeah.
These aren't official
so
people.
So the people who don't want to pay for their music are completely happy to buy flowers for someone over in like wherever the hell he is. But what I thought was really interesting is the wife said, "We've been married for 38 years. He proposed half an hour after we met. I said maybe. After a day, he had me convinced." So it took – they'd known each other for a day before she said yes. They've been married for 38 years.
Wow.
And he's still sending her flowers.
Yes, he's still sending her flowers.
Well, by proxy.
Yeah.
He got it done, man.
Himself, bastard.
Still counts.
What do you mean I never send you flowers? You have 45,000 in the backyard, but not one of them have a card from you.
Exactly. And then their marriage ended. So a major cache of fossils was found here in La La Land. Workers excavating an underground garage on the site of an old May Company parking structure in Los Angeles's Hancock Park got more than a couple of hundred new parking spaces. They found the largest known cache of fossils from the last ice age, an assemblage that has flabbergasted paleontologists. Researchers from the George C. Page Museum at the La Brea Tar Pits have barely begun extracting the fossils from the sandy, tarry matrix of soil, but they expect to find to double the size of the museum's collection from the period, already the largest in the world.
So, it just means more wolf bones?
No. Well, one of the things that's amazing is that they found a nearly intact skeleton of a Colombian mammoth. Which they nicknamed Zed. Most of the other mammoths they found, I think they have 6 to 10 already, but they're mostly incomplete. They're like 1 to 2 bones or whatever.
Right.
This thing is 80% complete, and it had its full tusks, which was unreal because the tusks are, you know, they're keratin.
It's weird to sit there in the middle of Los Angeles in this museum and stare at the bones of a mammoth and a saber tooth. And know that that was roaming around where
right
you were
standing. Yeah. The dire wolves are the ones that get me because they're thousands of dire wolf skulls.
Or the giant sloth
that
they have at the La Brea Tar Pits. Like, I can't even conceive of what a giant sloth would look like. That just seems
What was also interesting to me was that there's one woman in there, and she's also one of the first Los Angeles Basin murder victims because she had her skull bashed in.
This place has a bad history, man.
But
it's also interesting.
Oh, yeah. And Zed, the mammoth, his tusks are made of dentin, not keratin. But they're almost completely intact. The team has also begun digging through the largest crater, but has so far excavated only an area about 6 feet by 4 feet and about 2.5 feet deep. What was interesting about this was because they wanted to get it off-site, they basically dug out the entirety of the parking structure and pulled it up like one big root ball for a tree and then took the whole big dirt pack over to the museum. And
they
just dug as deep as they could in one big area and then pulled the whole thing up all at once.
Is the area like the size of my rug here? Or the
no, it's huge. It's huge. They had to pull it in like a series of different containers. Hmm. And actually now they're excavating the mammoth out of one of these segments. They're basically like have the size of this room that they're excavating the mammoth out of. And they're doing that in the fishbowl lab that they have at the George C. Page Museum. Out of an area 6 feet by 4 feet and about 2.5 feet deep, from that small area, they've so far removed a complete saber-toothed cat skeleton, 6 direwolf skulls and bones from 2 other saber-toothed cats, a giant ground sloth, and a North American lion. That's just in their first segment of what they're pulling up. Wow. The tar has yielded more than 700 individual plant and animal specimens, 400 which have been cataloged. That was the other thing, was that a lot of the flora and fauna from the time period was destroyed by the last time the tar pits were excavated. Mm-hmm. Because they were just like, they were in a hurry to get to the bones. And oh, they just went right through that stuff. And now they're like having a chance to really pull up the leaves and the trees and like that, so they can draw a full picture of what it was really like during that time period. So it's fascinating.
It's kind of eerie when you go down there, because the tar pit still exists. It's a big, you know, it looks like a big lake with a thin,
always smells like with a bad
thin,
fart.
With a thin veneer of oil on top of it.
Yeah.
Or tar. But they've put these fake mammoths there where there's like a mammoth and a little baby mammoth on the side.
And the baby's stuck in the mud and it's going to die.
Like, there's another mammoth out in the mud that's like, you know, help me, I'm drowning. It's like kind of like gross.
it's a little yicky.
Yeah.
All right, is that it?
That's it for news for
me. Why don't we move on?
Nice.
So, all right. Apparently I've been told I have the most romance in my soul, so I have to spearhead this.
Excellent.
Nice.
The topic of the day is love conquers all, even death. Or true love never dies.
Yes.
So, and specifically with an emphasis towards cinema. So, to start off, what are your favorite movies that have this theme?
Ghost.
Ghost.
Ghost is the most obvious. One of mine is Princess Bride.
Oh! Yeah. I didn't even think of that.
Wesley dies, but doesn't. Comes back. Anyone?
Why do you remember? Were you burned by acid or something like that?
No, name some other ones that I've...
Here's a couple other ones that may kind of fall into this. And some of them are kind of on the edge, but they're kind of great anyway. So, Titanic.
Okay.
Yep.
The Corpse Bride, which is...
Of course.
Sure.
Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
I get it.
Actually death.
Huh. But it is death of the memory. Which
it's death of a part of you, and it still conquers all.
Yeah.
The Crow.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure.
The Abyss, in the sense that he
does bring her back from the dead.
Well, he brings her back from the dead, and he expects to die.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Star Trek. Spock. The love story between Kirk and Spock.
Yes.
So to speak.
Yahweh there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know?
Slash Spock.
Yeah.
And I think that's good to start off with.
Let me throw the others in there, too.
Sure, please. Oh, the others? Yeah, that's a great one. Did anyone see Meet Joe Black?
Yes.
Does that kind of
fall into... I was hoping Claire Forlani would be really, really famous because of Meet Joe Black, and never saw her again, really.
Does that kind of conquer... You know, love conquers death, actually, right?
Yes.
Well, there's also Heaven Can Wait.
Although she's...
Yeah, that's a good one.
But the thing is, she falls in love with Brad Pitt.
She falls in love.
Yeah. She falls in love with a guy in the coffee shop, and then is very confused by Brad Pitt as death, and then kind of falls in love with him too. Although he's not the guy from the coffee shop.
So, what is the common theme here? The common theme of today's episode is that.
Alec. All right, start up.
Is the premise that love does overcome all, right?
Start from the beginning.
The premise... So what is the common theme here between all of these movies that we're discussing right now? I would say the common theme is that love overcomes all. Even death cannot conquer love, right?
Yes.
So one of the other ones that I would actually put on the list would be... it's not a movie. It's a musical. All right. It's called Once on This Island. Which is a very direct version of what we're talking about, where the goddess of love challenges the god of death to a contest to see who's stronger.
Yeah.
You know, and so a lot of these come down to that basic premise.
Yeah, WALL-E, for God's sakes.
WALL-E.
WALL-E. Mm-hmm. Yeah, WALL-E is a great example. Mm-hmm. It's a lovely example. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, I think the thing is that what makes this so powerful is these are such two primal forces in our life
that love do seem to be at absolute war with each
other. Because death, you know, death is what takes our loved ones from us. Mm-hmm. You know, it is the most painful thing we can experience. And I think that what makes the theme that love conquers death so valuable to us is it's the feeling that there's something beyond There's something of value that survives.
But also, is it that sense that, you know, that girlfriend or boyfriend sense, you know, if a person leaves you in a relationship, if they go away from you, there's always a sense, well, they left me and I can't get them back. In a way, this is, they're leaving me and I can't get them back. Because something else, you know, I'm not losing them because of their emotion. I'm losing them.
Love interrupted.
Yes.
Rather than love ended.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
But
I think that's a great way of putting it. It's beautiful, actually.
I think it's actually – I'm going to put a twist on what you said, Peter, though. Yeah. I think about what makes these stories more important. It's not just love. It's not just generic love being stronger than the barrier of death.
Yeah.
It is specifically the love I had, the special love, the thing that I had.
It's true love.
Goes beyond that.
Mm-hmm. It's true love.
You know, mm-hmm. Even true love makes it sort of a blanket thing.
Mm-hmm.
So like
I
with the premise
so.
Of Ghost – For example, using Ghost, the classic Demi Moore, Patrick Swayze, Whoopi Goldberg movie as the example, you know, in that love story that takes place in that movie, not just anybody hangs around to look after the people that they left behind. It's that one special love, that the fact that they're intense devotion to each other was interrupted, was ended prematurely.
Mm-hmm. And it trumps other people's true love. Like, there's a so much crazier that they're the one exception to the rule that they're going to break out of the box.
Yeah,
Even death is,
you know, and this has been going on forever. I mean, it's the Orpheus and Eurydice, the, you know, Lot and his wife, you know, this symbolism has been going on for a very, very long time.
Lot and his wife?
He turns around, she turns into a pillar of salt, but he loves her so much, he's trying to bring her along. You know, he just can't look back and see her, you know, and she looks back, she turns into a pillar of salt.
Okay. All
right.
Yeah.
Right. I mean,
well, you know,
and that's connected to Orpheus and Eurydice. It's the same thing. Don't look back, otherwise.
Well,
back to Ghost for just one second, because I think that, you know, Ghost is one of the movies that has the clearest theme. Notice that when the very first question I asked was, you know, what is a movie that represents this? It's the first one that both of you guys jumped on because it is literally.
I have a very distinct connection to Ghost.
I think everyone does, though. I think Ghost is such. I mean, Ghost is the first movie you probably think of when you think about love conquering death.
Well, I fell in love with a girl named Molly. Right, who I was desperately head over heels in love with, and she left me for a guy named Kurt, I believe, and Carl, and in the movie Ghost, Molly is the name of Demi Moore's character, and Carl is the bad guy in it who's trying to take. And so I was watching that movie like, you know, I had a very personal connection to it because when I fall in love, I
but
fall.
But despite that, you despite know. Your, I mean, like Ghost was the first movie I thought of.
Right.
It was the first thing that Don mentioned.
Right.
I mean, I do think that this movie has a really special connection to this theme.
Right.
Because literally the character does die.
Mm-hmm.
And the moment he dies, it asks the question, can love conquer this death experience? And, you know, unlike something like WALL-E, where in the end, love conquers death.
Right.
And you see that love can conquer even death. This movie asks the question at the very beginning. And what's interesting is that in the beginning of the film, you know, he won't say, I love you. He always says
ditto.
Ditto.
Right.
Right. And what's amazing is that part of his arc is going from someone that can only say ditto to someone who can fully express his love for her.
Right.
So the final moment.
And it's fascinating because in the midpoint of the film, he says, I love you.
I love you.
And she says, Sam would never say that.
Right. But by the end, when he's being sucked up into kind of heaven, basically, he says, it's amazing, Molly, the love inside, you take it with you. Goodbye, Molly.
Yeah.
So when he says, you take the love with you, it says that love conquers even death.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very clear answer.
But what's interesting about some of these stories is that, and in fact, a lot of these stories, the relationship does not go on.
No.
There's just enough, like for example, Ghost, the only reason why he stays is not because he wants to continue the relationship. He does it to save her.
Yeah.
And so love is only the vehicle in which it buys him time.
Because he still does want to be with her. I mean,
no, but,
in fact,
but
he does.
At the end, he says, I'm just going to tell you that I always loved you, but goodbye.
Right.
And he goes.
And there, if I think that's an essential part of all of these, where love and death cross, love may survive, love may break the barrier, but death is the door that must be stepped through. And to bring up a counterexample, I'm sure some of our listeners have watched the TV series Futurama, and I'm sure a lot of people have seen the episode where Fry's dog ends up waiting for him in front of the
store.
That
is the saddest episode of a cartoon I have ever seen.
Okay, so for those of you who aren't familiar with it, Fry gets frozen in time, goes to the future, and he's remembering about the dog he had, and the final line he has is, "Oh, well, I'm sure Scraps went on to find another master and had a great life." And then the episode goes back in time. You see the dog waiting for him in front of the pizza store. Years go by. The trees wither. The pizza store
The dog
falls
just
apart.
Gets older and older.
The dog
older,
gets older, older and older and older, and then one day the dog just stops.
Yeah, because the thing was, he basically had regenerated his dog as a clone, and then they convinced him out of it because it wasn't right. It wasn't the same dog.
Right.
And he was like, well, Scraps probably went on after me. And then we see that the dog, was...
And this is partially actually based on a true story about a policeman's dog in England, I believe, who, when the policeman died...
Oh, just sat on his grave and died.
He sat on his grave every day for years until eventually he grew old, and that's where the dog died.
Right.
So... That's the flip side. If the person doesn't say goodbye, it changes from a beautiful, bittersweet, romantic story to an awful, heart-wrenching tragedy of separation defeating love in a lot of ways.
Right.
That's the Orpheus thing. I think vampire stories partly feed on that, which is these are people who have kind of tricked... They're undead. They've tricked them. And there's always usually kind of a romantic bent on the story where they've taken a lover and dragged them through the years. Yeah. And then it's been...
Highlander asked that question, because he has this whole... He's a bitter guy in certain ways because he can't fall in love because everybody he ever loves dies.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But, I think another thing is that usually these stories end in a person leaving to die is I think that maybe we wouldn't buy it if it didn't end that way. I think death is programmed maybe into us. So we like stories like Ghost where we say, oh my God, their love conquered death. But I'm not going to believe this if they conquer it forever. He's got to leave her and die because that's the way it happens.
Right.
Well, I think part of it is death is finality. If they don't die after they die, then they didn't die. It's you can't conquer death without there being death.
Ghost could have ended that he stayed a ghost and stuck by her and they lived the rest of their lives where they could, he could move pennies around and,
But would we appreciate it as much if there wasn't a cessation, if there wasn't a stopping point?
If there wasn't
that energy of, oh God, wouldn't it be great if they got to stay together? Then, if they...
Well, it also tells us that death is a doorway. It's not an end. Mm-hmm. That there's something on the other side.
But it's also a reference point, We go because there is bad, there is cessation, there is stoppage of this feeling that I have. It makes me appreciate this feeling in this moment that much more.
Yes.
Let me talk about Heaven Can Wait is an interesting story because it kind of contradicts what I just said in a way. There is a sense of loss, but the end of that movie, spoiler alert, 1970s movie about ready to be spoiled here. At the end of that movie, after the two characters fall in love, one of which is dead and been put back into a body, he's going to be found a new body, and the new body will wipe out his memory, and he will then live the rest of his life as somebody else. And he...
Kind of like Wally.
He's saddened because he loves this woman. So he tells her, hey, if a guy walks up to you and looks into your eyes... could you please just give him a chance? And she's like, what are you talking about? Then he goes off and he inhabits this other body. Completely, his mind is erased. But at the very, very end of the movie, the woman meets this new man and she essentially sees his soul in him. She doesn't know for sure or anything, but she just has this weird feeling. And then you understand that they're going to live maybe the rest of their lives together again. Mm-hmm. So they not only cheat death, but he doesn't go to heaven. But there is kind of a sense of loss because they have to start over. But there's this kind of just a seed that helps you kind of understand that somehow their souls, no matter what the memory is like, there's somehow their souls are going to be together forever, which I think is an interesting twist on that story. And by the way, makes that movie.
There's a movie with Bob Hoskins and Denzel Washington called Heart Condition, which I don't know if you remember.
Sounds
this.
Terrible.
It's actually pretty much a terrible movie. But what was interesting about this is that it's talking about love and racism. And Bob Hoskins is he's a huge racist, you know, he's sort of a pain in the ass guy, and he has a heart attack. And Denzel Washington is this wonderful up and coming defense attorney, lawyer, great black guy, and he gets into a car accident and he dies, but he's a donor. And so his heart ends up in Bob Hoskins' body. Mm-hmm. And then his ghost ends up haunting Bob Hoskins. And in order for Bob Hoskins to get him to go away, this black man who's haunting him, he has to do all these things and solve his murder, mm-hmm. you know, and solve how he got killed. And he comes to love a lot of the things that he hated beforehand through this aspect of their connection through their heart. Mm-hmm. And it's actually a movie that is sort of badly done, but which I found fascinating in sort of the conceptual concept.
I think, again, another one of the central components of these things, that going into what you're talking about as far as the door closing, saying goodbye, mm-hmm. right, being such an essential point, is I think when you lose someone, and I've been lucky so far, I've only lost a few people in my life. I haven't lost anyone desperately close to me like this. It's the knowledge that you never knew anything you did with them was the last time. Mm-hmm. You never knew this was the last time I was going to hold their hand. I never knew this was going to be the last time I tucked my son in at night.
Right.
You know, you don't know these things. And I think often to fulfill the desire for love from beyond, right, it's not the feeling that they're going to be with you forever, although I'm sure that's a wonderful feeling. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the feeling that they loved you enough to cross the unpassable barrier to tuck you in one last time,
right,
to hold you one last time. Mm-hmm. And movies that remind me of that are things like what was the name of this movie, Robert Downey Jr. He's grown as a little kid and they're like these four ghosts
with him.
Each of them have one thing they wanted to do in their life
and
they're
singing
never did.
There's a lot of singing and dancing. Yes,
damn it,
what is it?
It's a Robert Downey Jr. movie. It's got Alfre Woodard in it, if I remember right, and Kira Sedgwick is in it.
Yes. She's one of the ghosts as well.
Oh, Matt's looking it up right now.
I'll find it.
But the basic premise with this is it's him being surrounded by four ghosts who didn't know him. They had no connection to him in life. Mm-hmm. But those four ghosts need him to help each of them do one thing in life that they never had the chance to do.
Oh, okay.
And for two of them, if I remember correctly, it was just to let them know, let someone they loved know that they cared. That's all
heart
it was.
And souls.
Heart and souls. That's it.
It's like blithe spirit.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, yeah,
that seems to be the most common theme. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily, you know, to spend the rest of eternity with them. It's not to, you know, necessarily even save them from the bad guy.
But essentially, why are we attracted to this so much? Is it the essential nature of saying just love the moment? Love what you have while you have it, rather than waiting to have to go over?
I think it's, again, it's
that we love loss, that feeling of I had something just like that.
I think it's the opposite of that. I think it's not that we love loss. I think it's that we fear loss. Hmm. That love is something that, you know, look, I think about my wife, okay? And I was watching a TV show the other day, and this guy's wife gets killed in an ER room when a doctor makes a mistake. She shouldn't have died. And he just breaks down and he just starts crying. He goes, I want my wife. I want my wife. I want my wife back. I want my wife. And I just was like, I was really affected by that. I was like, I can't imagine, you know, I cannot imagine, you know,
what would you do? Right.
You know, and that's terrifying, you know, because you have what is the most important thing in your life, which is love. And you have the thing that is the destroyer.
It is.
The great destroyer. And it's the one.
It's inevitable.
It's the inevitable destroyer. It's Shiva. You know? It destroys and unmakes.
Mm-hmm.
And we love the concept of that love survives that, because it takes the thing that is the most precious of our things and tells us that it will still be there on the other side. That even if we lose our body and everything else, that will still exist.
I think it's really important to point out one thing that you just said, which was the fear that this death, this end, ends and unmakes.
Yeah.
And what these stories are is the affirmation that it may end, but it does not unmake.
Absolutely.
There is something that does survive that is not undone by death that remains with you. And for someone like me, I mean, clearly it's not just about fear of loss. You know, I don't have a wife. I don't have anyone in my life with that sort of relationship. But I'm just as moved when I watch Ghost or when I watch that guy go through that loss.
Yeah.
So there's something more primal to it going on. And I wish I had a stronger contribution to it than that. But if it was purely
about... We love you.
I want Peter back.
I want my Peter back. Wait, no. That's more of a... That's a bad sentence.
Yeah.
But... clearly, it's going into a deeper place that all of us can understand, you know, even if it's just sort of switching it back to the loss of a parent, yeah. Which is another common theme in these, you know.
Let me bring up another. And then this thing happens all the time. The concept that love resurrects people from the dead.
Mm-hmm.
Live, damn it, live. Live! And you pound, and you kiss the person. They're dead. They are dead, dead, dead. The kiss brings them back.
Yeah.
It happens.
Sleeping Beauty, for God's sakes, you know?
The Abyss, it happens.
The Abyss.
And every...
Fight! Fight!
Yeah. I freaking love that
but
scene.
But that's like in every
I always want
episode
to know.
Of action yeah. TV show.
However, in The Abyss, I always want to know how many takes that took, because that is a roughneck scene where they are absolutely at the end of their ropes bringing her back.
I think, isn't love bring in the fifth element, bring her back from the dead?
No.
Didn't she die
in the end? No, you don't know what the hell you're talking about with that movie.
Anyway, but
I don't even know you, man.
But this is like a very common thing that it actually will change it.
Yeah.
It's not from
The Notebook, for God's sakes. Which I mean, he's essentially she's an Alzheimer's patient, but she's not there. She's not his wife,
mm-hmm.
and then just telling her this story about their love mm-hmm. brings her back to him. Yeah, which is it's fascinating.
Here's an interesting concept in Sandman. By Neil Gaiman, you know, typically death is portrayed as something scary.
Right.
In Sandman,
right.
Out of all the characters, the one that is the friendliest and most lovable
is death. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Who is portrayed...
The most human.
The most human
mm-hmm.
and caring.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, death coming to you is actually an act of love.
Yep.
Was an interesting thing.
Yep. I thought that was a really, really neat take on, especially since, you know, he has this fight with the demons and they're worried about death. And he's like, oh, no. I'm the one you need to worry about.
Right. Death. Well, you know, and what's interesting is the concept, you know, this is another take on, you know, when we talk about Shiva, the destroyer, there's actually two sides to Shiva, you know, which is Shiva is the destroyer in the sense that it's the unmaker. But sometimes you can't have growth without unmaking. You can't have growth without death. So Shiva is the thing that destroys something so that it can get to the other side. It can get to something that's better.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Shiva unmakes the person that you were yesterday so you can be the person you are today.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's also, you know, it's interesting. Another one of these things that pop up is the thing that the person that you love who has died gives you when they leave is permission to let go and not be connected. It's like, go love another.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is a theme that always pops up. It's not, I'll see you in 50 years when you die, you know, hold out. It isn't that. It's, I'm letting you go. Please
let
love
go
another.
Right.
And
isn't that always?
What's that?
Always, the Richard Dreyfuss film with, is that Holly Hunter?
Almost every single AIDS movie from the 80s, too.
Right.
Like, yeah. There's a scene in Longtime Companion where, like, this guy, you watch this guy die forever, and then finally, like, his longtime companion sits down next to him and says, you know, it's okay.
Right.
It's fine. And the guy just dies.
Boom. Always is the airplane one?
Airplane one, yeah. Where, well, Dreyfus is he's a pilot, and he dies in the thing, and he basically, he's trying to get, I think it's Holly Hunter. Is it Holly Hunter?
Yeah.
To pay attention to him, and he's trying to get John Goodman to pay attention to him, and finally he has to let go, but he also has to watch her falling in love with someone else. You know?
It is interesting. You know, and but we do see real life effects from that too.
Mm-hmm.
Like right after Christmas, there's a drop off. There's an increase in natural deaths, if I understand correctly.
Increase in suicides too.
Well, let's stick with the natural deaths for this discussion. It's a little different. No, actually, that's not true. Increase in suicides is before Christmas.
I thought it was Thanksgiving, actually.
Maybe.
Okay.
Maybe. But the point is, in the United States at least, people seem to hold on for Christmas.
Hmm. Yeah.
Then the natural causes kick in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just, it's sort of an interesting fact that, yes, then that is a love thing, I think.
Oh, absolutely. Actually, you know? the one of the books that I've cried the most at was, surprisingly, the John McCullough Adams book, the biography of Adams. And the fact that as I was reading the end of it and reading about Jefferson and Adams fighting to die on July 4th.
Yeah.
Years and years and years after their deaths, and both of them were like, Adams still lives, Jefferson still lives. They're both thinking that the other person is still alive. But they fought for the love of this country, for the love of a concept, for an idea that they believed in, to the end of their days, and then died on that day. That was that passion just swept me up. And the end of the book, I'm just reading, I'm like, and he loved the country to die. It was horrible.
It was a
soppy mess.
Kind of a strange story, but when my grandfather passed, he had said that he did not want to have a religious ceremony.
Mm-hmm.
So we all got on this boat. We were going to spread his ashes out in the ocean. So we got on this boat, and we're out on the river, and we're going along, and it's a very beautiful day, and dolphins come up, and they're swimming along with us, and it's kind of neat. And then we get out to the mouth of the where the river meets the ocean, right? And we look out. And there is some waves coming in. There are like 6 and 8 foot waves out in the channel. Mm-hmm. So we're all like, okay, we're just going to take the boat out. We're going to go out as far as we can get. We're going to, you know, put the ashes out in the ocean because he wanted them in the ocean. We're going to turn and come back.
Mm-hmm.
So we get out there, and just as it's time to put the ashes out there, one of my aunts pulls out a Bible.
Mm-hmm.
It, you know, no one knows she's going to do this. And continues to give a 30-minute eulogy.
Wow.
In 6 foot waves where we're all going like, So it's time we spread the ashes, you know. We turn around, we come back in. And it's weird because as soon as we got back home and we came in the door, as my aunt came in and came around the corner, there was this thing that was hanging on the wall that went flying off the wall and landed on the ground and shattered. And it literally, like, it was on the wall, hanging on the hook. The hook was still there. The hook didn't break, and this thing went and hit the ground and shattered. For some reason, my mom found this incredibly comforting because she's like, it's Grandpa telling us that he's pissed off. You know? I mean, but that was the moment because she was so worked up. But literally in that moment, like, that was the thing that, like, was the release.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, oh, he's still there.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
And she needed that sense of coming from beyond to let.
But what's interesting is it was pissed off conquers all.
That's another episode. Those movies exist too.
Well, that's kind of an aspect of Ghost as well, is he has to find his rage and his anger and concentrate it in order to move things. To move. I mean, that's the thing that I always thought of in that scene where he's moving the penny.
Mm-hmm.
Is that he's ticked. Like, he's having to be ticked to move the penny across the room. And I'm like, really?
Well, you know, rage and love in these stories often get crossed.
Yeah, it's
like,
passion.
Look at The Crow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, The Crow is about The Crow is about vengeance.
Yep.
Yeah.
And a love story.
Where do you think I don't know, maybe this doesn't fit.
Where do I think Brandon Lee...
Does Unforgiven fall into this at all? Because it's such kind of a... you never know what happened.
It ain't about deserve.
Not Unforgiven.
No, you got the wrong
the other one. The other Clint Eastwood movie where he's shit.
Which Tombstone? One?
Describe it a little bit.
One where he comes back and like he's like an angel and he's got bolt holes all in him. Ah, hell.
Bullet holes.
Anyway,
Clint Eastwood was in a movie where he had bullet holes in him.
Like he was still alive even though he'd been shot.
Yeah, like he kind of came back from the dead to kind of, and his wife and family had been murdered, and he came back to.
Wow, I'm in awe that I don't know what this movie is.
Yeah, it's filmed in Idaho.
No idea what you're talking about.
Sure, it's Clint Eastwood.
Yeah.
Huh.
Well, damn it.
Have to try and figure it out.
Hell. Anyway, sorry, guys.
We'll figure it out.
We should have laptops here in front of us.
We kind of do, but yeah.
Anyway, do we have anything else to add to this?
No, I think we're good.
Yeah.
I think that's a good spot to end.
I feel nice right now.
Excellent. Well, we have
a little bit.
We have, you know, the Demon Lord hasn't made a visit in a while, so we've decided to call upon him with a question we got from a listener. We always get mail for Demon Lord, but it's hard to get him. He's very busy, so it's hard to get a track on him.
So this says, Dear Demon Lord, I've been trying to get a voiceover agent for the last year with no luck. Do you have any advice? It's from Clint Keepin.
Well, first of all, you'll need your supplies. 7 blue or black candles. Black is better, much more aesthetically pleasing. But it can be somewhat difficult to obtain them from your local Bed Bath and Beyond. Not like the good old days when they were made from scratch with tallow and goat's blood. Ah, miss those days. Next, you'll need an appropriate incense. Frankincense, myrrh, saffron are all good, but opium is the best. So don't forget to detach your fire alarm before you start. There's nothing quite so embarrassing or annoying as watching a noob mid-summons try to unhook a fire alarm. It takes all the gravitas out of the situation. Finally, you'll need a copy of the Necronomicon. The ones bound in human skin are the best. It adds the right decor to the proceedings. But, you'll probably be like most of the wannabes these days. Get a paper-bound copy from your local bookstore or from Amazon. Really, I mean, arcane knowledge isn't just what it used to be. Now, technically speaking, you really don't have to use a summoning circle or pentagram. Simply reciting the words is enough to bring up any demon to you. Now, many of you may have been warned that a summoning circle is necessary to protect you from a demon. But if you're respectful, you should be just fine. If you absolutely feel obligated to use one, sand is actually a much stronger summoning tool than chalk. It's complicated, but suffice it to say that demons have deep underlying affinity for the essence of earth, and chalk just doesn't do the trick. If you're following the steps I've outlined, the room should be nice and smoked up, so once you've summoned the demon, it's important to get a strong fan and point it at him so that you can see better. At this point, you are a simple ecclesiastical transaction away from achieving all the success that you want in the voiceover acting or hell, any other realm you want to conquer.
Geekson takes absolutely no responsibility for any advice the Demon Lord gives. One should always take into consideration when seeking advice from the Demon Lord that he is in fact the father of lies. Following his advice can lead to death, mutilation, loss of firstborn, podcasting, eternal damnation and torment, excessive whiplash, projectile vomiting, and extremely bad acting. If you use opium as incense, there's a good chance you'll be stoned and not on your best game when the demon arrives. Also, Asmodeus, Belial, and Michael Eisner aren't really beginner-level demons. They're not happy about the constant summoning, and they weren't considered very friendly to begin with. Asmodeus's nickname is Master of Eternal Torments. Belial is better known as Ravager of Souls. Michael Eisner is known as the Scourge of Glendale. Summon them at risk to yourself and anyone within a 3-mile radius of you. Finally, one should always use a summoning circle when calling a demon and should always use chalk when drawing one and never use sand. You never want to break a summoning circle's boundaries. Most importantly, if you do use sand, never turn on a strong fan which is pointed towards it, since it has a bad habit of blowing your protective circle away and leaving you at the mercy of a very pissed off entity from the underworld who probably hasn't eaten anything in the last 10,000 years. Please continue to do your own due diligence and consider that the only truly safe way to summon a demon is not to summon one at all. Consider a demon abstinence program at any of your local schools.
Man, those disclaimers are just getting out of control.
Yeah.
I didn't even listen to any of that.
Yeah, well, you know. It's always projectile vomiting and anal leakage.
You know, to get ahead in this business, you have to be willing to put up with a few things. That's all I'm saying.
True.
It's like Olestra.
Well, anything else before we move on?
I think we're good.
I think we've done a Geeks On episode.
Excellent.
Yay! Have a geek week, everybody.
Have a great geek week.
Bye.
Rock it out. Bye.